Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we're going to talk to my good friend and a good friend of the Soapbox, David Swanson. We're going to talk about his new book, Killing is Not a Way of Life. We're going to talk about many more issues and current events, and also who is killing not a way of life to. Certainly it's a way of life for the Empire and here in the Empire. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with David Swanson. David Swanson, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hi, Cindy. Great to be here.
It's nice to talk to you again. It's been a little while since we last talked to you. Maybe
yes.
Since your last book.
Same problems in the world, though.
Yeah, exactly. Those never go away. So, David, we've been friends for a long time. We started in, I think, May of 2005. Around the Downing Street minutes, the exposition of that. Now, of course, we've found out from the Senate that the U.S. does torture, and I don't think anything came out in that report that, you know, we didn't already know about. And so the wars are still going on. The ones that Obama, quote unquote, inherited from Bush, and the ones that Obama has started himself. The Congress, the House of Representatives, just passed a bill authorizing war against Russia, essentially. And I'm not seeing, I'm trying to organize, but, you know, it's going very slow, opposition to these imperial racist wars. And I see very little opposition out there. What's your opinion, and why do you think that is?
Well, I completely agree with you in terms of what the problem is. And I know that I agree with you in terms of the most obvious primary reason why there is such a lack of activism and resistance in the United States. And that is, of course, partisanship. I mean, we've been screaming this for years since before Obama moved into the White House. The peace
right.
movement dropped off, all of its funders dried up, not in 09, but in 07, in
right.
anticipation of the need to put in a Democrat and back off the activism. And if George W. Bush or any Republican were reported to be going through a list of men, women, and children on Tuesdays and picking which ones to murder and murdering them, the streets would be filled, you know?
Right.
A very, very difficult situation. Dr. Martin Luther King famously said we needed to take on militarism and extreme materialism and racism.
Right.
Well, taking on militarism seems to be a very partisan and limited and constrained movement thus far in the United States, with some stellar exceptions that we can talk about. Taking on extreme materialism, my God, you got to be kidding, in the United States.
Right.
I mean, again, with pockets of resistance. But taking on racism has suddenly burst forth to have its 15 minutes in the corporate media, because the independent and social and individual media has been showing us how police murder unarmed black men.
Mm-hmm.
If we can make the connections between the things that get these brief moments in the sun and the overall need to reform a society dedicated to violence and a war machine that is training and arming those local police and so forth, we may be able to get somewhere. There are people leading the way. There are resistors converting public opinion in their communities against their local U.S. Air Force bases that are drone murdering people thousands of miles away. And these activists are risking and serving prison time to make this happen. There are people taking on nuclear weaponry in a major and useful way. There are people in the United States teaming up with resistors to U.S. expansion and bases in Europe and Asia and Africa that are having some impact. There are groups resisting and seeking actual accountability and prosecutions for the torture and the warrantless spying that are getting somewhere and winning minor victories. But it's absolutely shameless the extent to which people in this little corner of the world accept an evil that is harming the entire globe.
Oh, absolutely. One thing that I was thinking of while you were talking was that I think the militant protests against police brutality, I think with the big march Al Sharpton had in Washington, D.C., I think he just got involved to channel it and to tame it. And so, you know, maybe that energy is being channeled into Democratic politics as we speak right now. But it is very disheartening that few people are making the connection, like Martin Luther King Jr. did in that speech Beyond Vietnam, Building the Beloved Community. You know, he said that there's a connection between the wars abroad and the poverty and racism, like you said, and materialism at home. And when I was running for governor, I was trying to tell people this. California has the highest poverty rate in the nation, but of course we also send almost $30 billion a year to the federal government for these wars. What could we use that money for in California? And, you know, to build the beloved community, to build a society where, you know, killing is not a way of life. And that brings us back to your new book, Killing is Not a Way of Life. Tell my listeners about that book, about your new book, and Killing is Not a Way of Life to whom? To what are you focusing on in this book?
This is the problem with the titles of all of my books. I write called War is a Lie, and everybody screams at me, "What do you mean? There are wars. I've seen them. There was one last year." You know, and I write this book called Killing is Not a Way of Life, and every comment I've gotten is, "What do you mean? It is our way of life." Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it is, but it's a way of death. It's not a way of life. Yeah. It's not life-affirming. It's not life-sustaining. It's not humanitarian. It's not necessary or good in any way. Destructive and counterproductive on its own terms and decent moral terms as well. And it's something we need to change if we are going to be a society and a culture that affirms and betters life rather than celebrating and causing death. That was, in any case, my secret intention in coming up with that title. I think in some ways better than my books that have been single long piece arguments, uh-huh, because of being a collection of short immediate reactions to things in the world, be they events or other people's books or trends or whatever, because the collection I think presents my worldview, which is not terribly unlike yours, I think. A view of someone who is often asked questions that come from completely outside that worldview. Like, if we don't use drones, what should we use? Or if we didn't have prisons, we'd all be raped and murdered. Is that what you want? And these sorts of questions. And I think a logical argument to people about the harm that prisons do and the alternatives to prisons and so forth goes a certain distance with some people. But I think a complete perspective on how someone views the world who has no use for prisons or wars and so on can be more useful, and it can also be read in the short little bits that fit the U.S. attention span, because it's not because it is that sort of collection. But I completely agree with everything you said a moment ago, and I'm glad that Al Sharpton was protested and the stage taken over at his event, and I think that will continue, that there's real grassroots momentum, but it's not, of course, aware of the danger you describe. And you see this video on YouTube of this wealthy Harvard Business School graduate African American explaining how his kids have to dress a certain way and act a certain way to avoid being killed because they're black. And he proudly displays the photos of Barack Obama on his kids' bedroom walls as a good black model to make sure we understand he's not trying to become white. Well, here's a mass murderer as a model for kids who are trying to avoid being wrongly seen as murderers. And it's not that that man is celebrating mass murder. It's that he's made himself blind to it, as most people, black, white, and otherwise, have made themselves blind to it. And this is the number one way in which war is killing people, through stupid, blind obedience and acquiescence to a program that takes $1 trillion a year from this country and another trillion from the rest of the world put together, and dumps it into a criminal operation, largely about oil, that drives the consumption that in turn drives the wars. This country spends $80 billion a month building roads and highways, when $30 billion a year would end starvation on Earth. Mm-hmm. Those are our priorities.
Well, for example, what you were just talking about, UC Berkeley in California was famous in the 60s for the free speech movement and the anti-Vietnam War protests, and scared the crap out of Ronald Reagan, who was our governor at the time, and they were out in force after the Michael Brown verdict and the Eric Garner verdict. I mean, out in force in Berkeley, shutting down highways, shutting down railroad tracks. And to me, I think it's great. I'm not demeaning the protests against police brutality at all. I think it's great, and I'm glad that the young people are out there. I'm glad that the young people of Berkeley are caring about something other than, the things that the young people now are caring about. But they have John Yoo is a professor at their school. And World Can't Wait for years has tried to foment some kind of awareness of that and outrage. They're, especially with the torture report coming out, they are like allowing this a war criminal to be a professor at their university.
Yeah, I've been there to protest him and been to his house up on a hill there to protest. And it's a small group of protesters trying to mobilize the rest of the campus. And they've produced brilliant videos and they've done great strategic creative actions. But there's not the sort of resistance that there should be. And I think there could be, and I think we're actually seeing, despite the fact that most of us already knew most of what was in the Senate's summary of its torture report, things are starting to change. The fact that you have the New York Times and Washington Post now finally using the word torture when describing the actions of the U.S. government, the fact that you have opinion columns from very established and power-focused human rights groups advocating prosecution. The fact that you have the European Union and the ICC at least pretending that they are considering prosecution. The fact that there is increased movement around impeaching Jay Bybee, the judge in, out there on the West Coast who signed off on John Yoo's memos as his superior. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're actually seeing a little bit of revived interest, and it wouldn't take that much to push it over the top. I mean, this is what we always fool ourselves into thinking we need so much more than we actually do. I mean, I've found working just for an online activist group like RootsAction.org that just does emails and petitions, that even those win victories all the time. I mean, we just got them to drop their attempt to put this author and reporter, James Risen, in prison for refusing to reveal a source. And a year ago, a year and a half ago, all of us together, but a very small segment of the population doing very easy things, stopped a war. They wanted to attack Syria. They were gung-ho to attack Syria. Leadership of both parties, every corporate media outlet and Wall Street knew those missiles were going into Syria, and people said hell no, and together with some insiders and some foreign governments, stopped the thing. A little over a year later, they show people some videos of men having their throats slit and stir up a good deal of fear and propose to bomb the opposite side in the same war, and people allow it to happen. And tell each other it's inevitable, it's impossible to stop, nobody's ever stopped a war, it's hopelessly corrupt, when just over a year before we stopped one. And so we have to remember how little it would take to turn things around if we could get a few of our neighbors and a few of their neighbors to join in.
Well, I think I have a differing opinion on Syria. First of all, we didn't stop it. It was delayed. And I just think that it was more to do with Russia. You know, Russia putting the kibosh on it. Then, I mean, David, look at it in 2003. There were millions of people out against the war in Iraq, and it still happened. And really, the anti-Syria protests were tiny in comparison to that. We had maybe 60 people in Sacramento standing by the federal building on a Saturday.
But in 2003, Cindy, and in 2002, when Congress was voting on attacking Iraq, and you'll be pleased if I remind everyone that the Democrats controlled the Senate and that most of the Democrats, like the Republicans, were in favor of attacking Iraq. All of the conversation was around the need to be a serious leader and attack Iraq. There was no, and every Democratic senator who wanted to run for president voted to attack Iraq. Mm-hmm. Obama and what's his name from Vermont who ran the time before had the good fortune not to be in Congress at that time, or they would have voted yes like their colleagues. This time around, after a decade of people like you and millions of people around this country explaining what a catastrophic evil disaster it was to attack Iraq, the conversation on Capitol Hill was all around not wanting to be that jerk who votes for another one of these things. This was the conversation in the summer and fall of 2013. It was a conversation created by a decade of resistance to war and war propaganda that had won over clearly the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and numerous insiders. And when the House of Commons said no, numerous foreign nations said no, and the public said no in a way that was indeed sort of a perfect storm, because of Jewish holidays, AIPAC was out of town, Congress members were home in their districts doing town halls, people were confronting them with why do you want to get in a war on the side of Al-Qaeda and so forth. That public sentiment played a much more significant role than Russia's willingness to go along with getting rid of Syria's chemical weapons, which it had been willing to work on for years. Syria had been willing to turn over its chemical weapons for years and had proposed a weapons-free Middle East, which of course was a problem because that would include Israel becoming a weapons of mass destruction free Middle East. But we break our own necks running to find some explanation for why everything we do can't possibly be having any result. And it isn't the case. I've seen marches and rallies and petitions and press conferences turn these people around on things big and small. And yes, of course, any war that's stopped is a war delayed because the warmongers want that war. And they're going to keep coming back for it year after year. And if you don't stop it over and over again until we get out of this war machinery that creates this momentum for more wars, they're going to keep coming back again and again. But that doesn't mean you can't stop it again and again. And we shouldn't realize the ability to stop some of them again and again.
Well, I don't say we haven't had any effect, because we obviously, you know, have had a big effect with our activism and our protests and things like that. I think we have more effect on people, though, than the torturers and traitors in the U.S. government. And because they'll find a way, like you just said. All of a sudden, people are getting beheaded, and a few people have allegedly been beheaded, but Saudi Arabia beheads many people every month. And Saudi Arabia is like a huge ally of the United States and Israel. We don't go and bomb them. I'm not advocating bombing Saudi Arabia. I'm just highlighting the hypocrisy of their flimsy excuses for bombing people.
Yeah, but people's televisions don't tell them that. Mm-hmm. Don't tell them that all sides in Syria, including the so-called moderates, behead people, that the Iraqi government beheads people, that when Barack Obama sends a Hellfire missile into a 16-year-old American and his five friends, that their heads don't remain on their bodies.
Right.
Nobody tells the U.S. public this on television or in newspapers, and so they have to find it out gradually. And sometimes it takes months and years. This is always the tendency with these wars, including the Afghan and Iraq wars, is for a substantial number of people to jump on board at first. Yeah, this will be the one good war that finally works well. And mm-hmm. and then within months, you start to see that slip and change, and part of it is the dollar cost or the cost to U.S. lives if it's not purely a drone war, but part of it is the illogic of it. And as we manage to start telling people that these wars are one-sided slaughters, and we point out that this humanitarian war involves President Obama tossing out his own rules on avoiding killing civilians because he's already killed so many civilians, that we're in fact bombing the opposite side of the war that we had this great moral obligation to bomb just a year before, that this is a war on the same side of as various evils in the U.S. propaganda system like Iran, people will start to object and say, can't we try something else? I mean, I think this is where the peace movement fell down in the years when we were most active and visible. We put so much emphasis on the financial cost and on the cost to U.S. troops and their families, which are huge costs and outrageously inexcusable horrors, that nobody knows that Iraqis died in the war on Iraq.
Right.
That a half million to a million and a half, probably a little over a million, Iraqis died, and some 4 or 5 million and now more made refugees, a country absolutely destroyed. I mean, Americans think that Iraq benefited and Iraqis are grateful, and yet they don't want another war because of the financial costs and the U.S. troops and how the U.S. suffered. Well, of course the U.S. suffered, but it didn't suffer on the scale that its victim suffered. And I think as we start to tell people those things, we're going to be forced to, because with these drone wars and volunteer armies and contractors, people are not going to see the cost to the aggressor. We're going to have to tell them the cost to the victim.
Yeah, no, I never did. I mean, I'm in the movement because of my personal loss, but I always emphasize the loss of the people on the other side, Iraqi, Afghans, you know, Yemenis, Libyans, whatever, you know. Yeah. It's horrible. I went to the movies yesterday. I hardly ever do that. But there's a movie coming up about Selma in 1965. And that when they were taking that, when the, you know, the civil rights marchers were crossing the bridge, and mm-hmm. the cops just beat the living crap out of them. It was on the news. And then people, white, black, and otherwise, like you just said, flocked to Selma to support the people who got beaten. And they said, they were interviewing them saying, oh, I came because I saw what was happening. And I said, I have to come here and support. People came to Camp Casey because they saw it on the news, and they came to support. You know, right. we saw protesters being beaten at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. And so, and then people supported our, you know, their protests and things like that. I think you touched on this. People don't see it on the TV box, so it must not be happening. And so how, David, I know you are on target, and you're working almost 24/7 trying to you know, tell people the truth. And now we do have the, you know, internet and social media. How do you see, compare your activism, like, say, back in 2004, 2005, to activism today with Facebook and Twitter? What is your analysis of that?
Yeah, I think the U.S. corporate media today, if it were transplanted back into the 60s, would not show what was happening in Vietnam the way that it did, which was far from ideal or perfect, but was there. And I think would not show the dogs and the fire hoses in the way that it did back then. It is so heavily trained in propaganda techniques and so subservient to those in power. You look at the Sunday talk shows this past weekend, and everyone has a torturer on it to talk about torture.
Right.
This is where the media has gone. Yes, we have still, so far, an open and free internet that we can use. It is still miles and miles away from being able to compete. We are able, when someone talks in the corporate media about Julian Assange or Chelsea Manning or any whistleblower, Edward Snowden, talks about them as a devil, as a traitor, then we're able to invert that and talk about them as heroes because they're known to people. When there's a country being advertised as in need of bombing, like Iraq, we're able to talk about alternatives to bombing Iraq to some limited extent because people have heard about Iraq. But we can't take the country of Bahrain that nobody's heard of and explain why the United States needs to radically transform its policy toward Bahrain. We don't have the power yet to create a new topic. Mm-hmm. RootsAction.org just today, as we're speaking, has launched a petition to get the charges dropped against Jeffrey Sterling, who's going to be the first man to actually taken to trial under the Espionage Act as a whistleblower since Ellsberg. And nobody has the slightest clue who Jeffrey Sterling is. And so we have to create a topic and then depict it in the right way. And we don't yet have the ability with the internet to get there. I mean, the Occupy movement happened because some very stupid cops and mayor and officials in New York allowed it to become a corporate media story. And when it got off the televisions, people thought Occupy was over. Even when they were at Occupy events, they would tell you it was over. You know, I mean, Camp Casey was the result of your brilliant strategy and people going with you there in Texas. But also the corporate media sitting there and George W. Bush doing giving them nothing to cover in the hot sun, and they're covering you and people seeing it and coming. It's when something slips into the corporate media that we then nudge it in a better direction with the internet. Somehow we're going to have to gather the strength and really the independence of thought and the freedom from partisanship to be able to create an agenda and advance it. And we're getting closer, and we will not get, and we will be miles set back if they take away the free internet.
Oh my gosh, I don't know what we're going to do.
I don't either.
So we are, I'm going to invite you right now. We are going to have the Spring Rising in Washington, D.C. from March 13th to the 18th. And wait, no, I'm sorry, 18th to the 21st. But on the Friday, I think it's the 20th, we want to have a summit to just talk about those things that you just said. You know, to break our chains to partisanship, to how do we go forward? How do we have a strategy that actually is solution based and results and getting results and tearing down this empire, not figuring out ways that we can have a kinder, gentler empire, because we've seen that that's failed in the last however long Obama's been president. So so we hope that you can join us as, you know, one of the people who has never given up all these years. And you're talking about, you know, Camp Casey and the corporate media. I get emails every day by people calling me a hypocrite because I'm not protesting Obama and Obama's wars. And I said, just because you don't see it on Fox News doesn't mean I'm not there. So, you know, just like Google me and you'll find out.
It's bizarre. I've seen the same criticism of you, Cindy, and of others. Why is she not choosing to be on network television every day? It must be because she loves Obama. As if people get to choose. You know, nobody other than Dick Cheney and John McCain gets to choose every day if they want to be on the corporate media.
How come I don't see you every time I turn my TV on now? I'm like, oh, because I've retired, obviously, and I'm obviously a big Obama lover, or you'd see me every day on the corporate media.
And I've been to, I mean, this is one example of billions, but I've been to rallies about Ferguson and Eric Garner lately and heard people on the left criticizing each other for infighting and bad strategy and bad sound bites as the explanations for why they aren't as effective as the people on the right, who have billionaires funding them and television networks dedicated to their cause. I mean, not that we're perfect, not that we shouldn't criticize ourselves, but my God, to blame ourselves for not being on an even playing field with the plutocrats is to miss the fact that they're plutocrats. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's insanity.
Right. Well, David, thank you for this interview. Tell my listeners where they can get more information about your book and hopefully order a trainload of them.
Yeah, please do. Go to your local bookstore or go to any online bookseller or go to my website, davidswanson.org, and it's called Killing is Not a Way of Life.
Thank you so much, David, and I hope you and your family have happy holidays and try to get as much enjoyment from them as you can. And life goes on, and we do the best we can, right?
Indeed. Keep doing what you're doing, Cindy. Thanks for everything.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's Cindy Sheehan's soapbox for today. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you learned something, and I hope you were inspired to seek out further information or further actions. And that's also Cindy Sheehan's soapbox for 2014. I can't believe this year is already almost over.
And thank you for supporting the show all year and for the past 5 years. When we come back, it'll be our 6th anniversary of Cindy Sheehan Soapbox in January. So I hope you and your families have a very amazing and wonderful holiday season. And I hope we all have a prosperous and revolutionary new year. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my assistant and my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank my occasional helper, Mikey. I'd like to thank David Swanson for his work as an activist and an author. And most of all, I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.